Okay, well, I'm reading from page 59 of the Little John booklets, if you'd like to follow along. Page 59, and starting at sort of halfway down that page, Jesus and Thomas is the heading, and that's starting at verse 24. Now Thomas, one of the 12, called the twin, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." And just over the page. Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name.
Aaron, thank you very much for reading that for us. May I add my own welcome. My name is Aaron. I'm also one of the ministers over at St. Helen's Church. I live over in East London, and at Mile End Tube Station each day, they have, like other stations I think, the saying for the day, a pithy statement as you walk in, put up to get you thinking and cheered on your way. You can kind of guess the things that they have, things like, "Be a rainbow in someone's cloud." I know. Well, how about this one? "Nothing is impossible. The word itself says, I'm possible." Did you get it? Okay. Well, how about this one? "If opportunity doesn't knock, build a door." Well, it depends on my mood. Sometimes I find them entertaining, sometimes a bit closer to highly irritating. But last week I was passing through the station, and printed in large letters at the ticket barrier was the wisdom for that day. And this is what it said. "For dust you are, and to dust you will return." That was brutal. I mean, it's so in your face, isn't it? I have no idea whose idea it was to put that one up that day. I'm not sure what the commuters thought, confronted with immortality like that first thing in the morning on the way to work. But of course it's true, but not a truth we choose to dwell on. But having said that, of course, we can't always avoid such thoughts. Just today, the news from Brussels has shocked us. And sometimes it becomes very close to home, doesn't it? Those we love endure great suffering, and then they go, and we miss them terribly. As the Booker Prize-winning author Julian Barnes puts it, "Death is the one appalling fact that defines life." And yes, every day here in London, 250 people die. Steve Jobs puts it like this: "If you live each day as if it were your last, someday you will most certainly be right. We know sooner or later our turn will come." And sometimes when we least expect it, maybe like on that tube station early in the morning, we're forced to think. And the question confronts us: what does my certain death mean for life now? If in 500 years there'll be no trace of me, any achievements I might reach, any relationships I've enjoyed, then bluntly, what's the point? And we wouldn't be the first to be confronted by questions like this. Leo Tolstoy wrote a short work entitled My Confession, where he said this: "My question, that which at the age of 50 brought me to the verge of suicide, was the simplest of questions lying in the soul of every man, a question without the answer to which one cannot live. What will come of what I am doing today or tomorrow? What will come of my whole life? Why should I live? Why wish for anything or do anything? Is there any meaning in my life that my inevitable death awaiting me does not destroy? More recently, I've been reading the recent bestseller, I don't know if you've seen it, When Breath Becomes Air. A talented surgeon in his mid-30s, Paul Calathini, was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer, and this is his dying memoirs. And in it, he's trying to make sense of life. But he found himself, quote, lost in the featureless wasteland of my own mortality. He goes on, the monolithic certainty of my future was deadening. Everywhere I turned, the shadow of death obscured the meaning of any action. You read that, and yes, the terminal diagnosis brings those issues into sharper focus, but they're there for all of us. Our situation, if we're honest, is bleak. But then what can we do? So most of us, I think, have just made a pact, haven't we? Make the best of the few years we might have, knowing all along there's no meaning or hope. Well, for a few minutes this evening, we're going to consider the experience of a man like us who knew the reality of death, and his name was Thomas. Now, Thomas had had his hopes raised by the life, the miracles, the leadership of Jesus Christ. But then those hopes were cruelly dashed when Jesus was nailed to a cross outside Jerusalem. Of course, life had to go on for Thomas and his followers. He'd obviously got himself busy, and then once he went back to his fellow disciples, and they bound up to him with news. Why not look at it with me, if you had this open, page 59, and it's verse, sentence 25. So the other disciples told Thomas, "We have seen the Lord." Imagine Thomas's response. Is this a joke? Because if so, it just wasn't funny. Thomas had lived with these guys. No doubt he considered them somewhat sensible and reasonable, but they've gone mad. And so he responds, as we read on, verse 25, "Unless I see in his hands the mark of the nails, and place my finger into the mark of the nails, and place my hand into his side, I will never believe." Now, here's why Thomas has got this moniker, Doubting Thomas. And I guess we're sympathetic, aren't we? After all, if someone was to tell you today that someone has come back from the dead, what would you think? Really? Who says? Was he really dead? Why should I believe that? We would doubt the claim. Because just like Thomas, we'd know full well death is final. Maybe that explains this somewhat gruesome test. It is gruesome, isn't it, that Thomas sets up, proposing putting his fingers into the marks caused by the nails in Jesus' hands, putting his hand into the wound caused by the spear piercing Jesus' side. I guess Thomas said that because he probably thought that's just never going to happen. Thomas is saying he's not interested in a merely spiritual resurrection, whatever that means. Thomas had no time for pretending Jesus lived on in our hearts, as some people say today. No, Thomas said, if anything, it's got to be true physical resurrection. But that's the problem. He'd seen the crucifixion. People who die like that stay dead. But it seems the other disciples stuck to their story. Can you imagine life for Thomas? There they are, presumably rejoicing, celebrating, convinced Jesus was alive, while he thought they were crazy. On it went, it seems, for days. No doubt he couldn't make head or tail of it. But maybe as the days wore on, he resolved not to let the disciples out of his sight again. And then sure enough, look down to verse 28. 8 days later, his disciples were inside again, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands, and put out your hand and place it in my side. Do not disbelieve, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." So imagine it. Thomas saw the face that he recognized, and then the familiar voice spoke. That same Jesus he'd known so well, but had also seen crucified, dead, and buried, was now standing before him speaking and clearly very much physically alive. And so Thomas can't deny the evidence before his eyes. He recognizes that, staggering as it sounds, that the Jesus he knew was before him, and that he must be, as Thomas says, Lord and God. Thomas saw him and believed. Now, as we hear that, I wonder what we think. Even if we want to be polite, I guess the thing we'd say is, well, okay, that's all very well for Thomas, but you can't expect me to believe that, because Thomas was there. He got to see the risen Jesus. Show me Jesus and I'll believe it too. Why doesn't God, if he's there, just make himself obvious? I'd be happy to believe in him. Well, listen to how Jesus responds then to Thomas, verse 29. Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." So Thomas, yes, believed what he saw, and he was right to do so. But according to Jesus, he should have believed his fellow disciples, taken their word for it without having to see Jesus himself, because that's how it would be for those who would follow. But again, I guess the question comes, but why then did Jesus show himself to Thomas? Well, just remember who Thomas is. We are reminded of this back up in verse 24. He was one of the 12. That is, one of those original disciples who'd been with Jesus right from the beginning, who'd seen it all. And the reason Jesus had these disciples was that when he had gone, they would be eyewitnesses. They would speak of all that they'd seen, including the resurrection, and tell the world, "I was there. Jesus is alive." And that is exactly what they did. In the decades following this, those disciples gave themselves to traveling far and wide around the Mediterranean with this shocking but wonderful news that death has been defeated and Jesus was alive. It actually made them very unpopular. It led to opposition and persecution. Their lives were under threat, but they still didn't deny what they'd seen. If they were making it up, you could imagine they'd quickly hold their hands up and say, "Sorry, wind up, not funny, we were joking." But they were convinced. They'd seen Jesus. And they'd rather die than deny what they'd seen. And it turns out that most of them did just that. Die, because they wouldn't deny what their own eyes had shown them. Okay, we might think. So they went around the Mediterranean. People in that generation could hear the news from eyewitnesses. But here we are, 21st century. What about us? Just turn over the page to those last couple of verses. Verse 30. "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." Do you see the point? We don't actually need to see the resurrected Jesus, because here in our hands is reliable, historical, eyewitness testimony from those who did see Jesus. So God has made it obvious for us, and here's the evidence. Jesus physically rose again from the dead. Resurrection is a reality. And in particular, Jesus is who he claimed to be. I wonder, have you ever read one of these eyewitness accounts? Many of us may have grown up with them in school or elsewhere. But I wonder if, as an adult, you've actually considered what Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John here wrote down for us. You can't reject Jesus or the resurrection unless you have a credible view of who Jesus was. So please read it and decide for yourselves. But make sure your view fits with what Jesus said and did. Speaking personally, the reason I follow Jesus today is, if you like, because no one has yet been able to give me a better explanation of what I find here and in the other documents than what Thomas recognized when he saw Jesus before him. He is alive and he is Lord and God. As we close, you might still say, okay, maybe. But even if so, so what? Okay, Jesus rose again, let's say, all those years ago. But is that actually appealing? What I mean is maybe expressed by, do you remember the vocal atheist Christopher Hitchens? He said not long before his death this, anything eternal is probably intolerable. Anything eternal is probably intolerable. And I think he was onto something. That is, we don't want to die, but then again, we don't want, if you like, existence as we experience it now to go on forever. So we're slightly trapped. But what now then? But again, I think this passage speaks to that. Two words for us to highlight that Jesus speaks to Thomas. First word is peace. Look back again to verse 26. Although the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Now those words are based on a traditional Jewish greeting, but there's far more to them here than that. When Jesus first appeared to the other disciples that week previously, again he had said to them, peace be with you. Now this is the third time recorded for us that Jesus said, peace be with you. And if we've read the gospel up to this point, we know why. Because lying behind this is the explanation for why life now, even as we have it, doesn't quite deliver what we hope. Because earlier in John's gospel, Jesus himself explained our predicament. He says, the problem with our world and our lives is that we've turned against our Creator. We've all done it. However respectable, therefore, you and I might appear, actually, we're at war with God. That's why the world is broken. That's why we don't get on with one another. That's why life doesn't satisfy and our bodies falter and die. But the most serious problem of it all, underlying it, is that God is angry with us. Now, I know we'd rather not hear that. We might be offended by it. That doesn't mean it's not true. And it's Jesus who said it. But he goes on to say the reason he came into the world was to do something about it. That's why he went to that agonizing death on the cross, so that he could come out the other side and say to Thomas, to the other disciples, and to us, peace be with you. That is peace between humanity, us, and God, our Maker, our most foundational, most urgent problem dealt with. Peace. The second word that Jesus uses here is blessed. Do you remember verse 29? That's where Jesus was explaining how future generations would come to believe. And he says there to Thomas, have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. So Jesus is saying all generations, we may not see Jesus in this world, but we can still be blessed. Now please don't be put off by what sounds like a religious sounding word, blessed. What it actually means is accepted by God and so enjoying all that flows from that. In verse 31, it's what was described as life in Jesus' name. We're talking here true life, meaningful life, satisfying life, the life we were made to enjoy, abundant life. The rest of John's gospel, if you read it, Jesus does those amazing miracles. He teaches authoritatively and passionately. And part of that, he is giving us a glimpse, a preview of the world he's going to bring about, this true life for his people to enjoy. It can start now, and one day it'll be experienced in full when Jesus will wipe away every single tear forever. And that life, above all then, will be to know God, the one true God, Jesus Christ, who he sent, the one who went to such lengths to win that life for us. I've just finished this book, and the last chapter of When Breath Becomes Air, well, it's written by Paul Kalanithi's wife, for the obvious reason. Earlier in the book, Kalanithi himself declares, death always wins. But does it? What if there is one who has convincingly demonstrated in history that death does not get the final word? Jesus rose again from the dead. We can know that for sure. And not just to more of the same kind of life. He came to die, to rise again, to share his life with us. The life worth having. The life that can start now and endures beyond the grave. It's for anyone who will go where the evidence leads and believe in him. Well, thanks for listening. I'm going to hand back to Chris.
And Aaron, thank you very much. It's given us lots to think about. As I said at the beginning, a chance now to ask questions. And just to reiterate the invitation, take the gloves off, so to speak. Write the question as direct as you like. Not too much swearing. I won't read that out. Write the question, and I will gather those in. Maybe a few people can help me gather those in. And in about 5-6 minutes, we've had a chance just to order them in some way. I will ask those questions on your behalf to an Aaron. So just a 5-minute break to write questions. Good. Well, if I can just break into conversations again. Thank you very much indeed for your questions, which are still coming up to the front. That's absolutely fine. Do feel free, if you have something that's sort of going through your head as I ask these questions to an Aaron, do just wave your hand in the air. One of the stewards can pick up the question and bring it up to me in the front. I'll do my best to incorporate it into the order of questions we've got here. Now, Aaron, you come and stand here. You'll be glad to know the questions are quite polite this evening. Let's kick straight. I mean, this is a really important one on local events. How can you hold yourself tall given the results of the recent rugby? I don't know. Who and Aaron's Welsh, if you haven't met an Aaron before. I'm English. Any comment on, or shall we move on?
We were robbed, and it's the try count that counts.
And Aaron also loves maths. Now, let's get down to even more serious things. Here we go. Interestingly, there were 5 questions which were all written by you on the authenticity of the Bible. Let's deal with these in one go. Let me just read out a few of them to get a flavour. How do we show that the Bible, the gospel, is not just merely a book? How can we be sure of the authenticity of the gospel? Something on historical fact. Is there robust historical evidence for the existence of the person of Jesus, his crucifixion? Can you say something on the Bible's authority?
Thank you. Well, why not start with the verses that we ended reading with today? So on page 60, this is end of chapter 20, where John tells us... Actually, keep a finger there. Why not turn back to the first page as well? So you'll see how John begins his gospel. So you remember the Christmas reading, the Word, one who was God and with God, there in the beginning, before the whole world began. Well, how on earth can we know anything about things like that? Verse 14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. The claim being God is no longer hidden in the dark. In a new way now, God has stepped into our world. That's what John is claiming. The Word became flesh. And then he says, dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. So if we were reading this for the first time, you'd say, what you're claiming, that God stepped into our world, that you've seen it, and you've seen his glory. And that's exactly what John is claiming. And then his gospel, this account, is then what John saw, what he witnessed, what persuaded him that this was God in the flesh. And then, so if you kept a finger there, towards the end in this verse on page 60 at the top, he says, now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So in Jesus' plan, as we know, he gathered those 12 disciples in particular, spent that time with them. And one of the main reasons for that was that when he died, rose again, had gone, they would go and speak the message around the world, but also write it down for future generations. That's why they lived with Jesus, went with him, saw these things, heard him speak. And that's what then is the reason we've got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Different perspectives written by different authors, but all of them eyewitness accounts about the same person of Jesus. And so the best way really to carry on this discussion is to read those, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You can't really comment on them until you've read them. And most people I know who do read it as an adult are surprised. I think it's fair to say it does read as history. It talks about people and places, and over the centuries, archaeology and research has confirmed that the historical details are accurate. There's no reason not to believe these. They are convincing. How have we got them? Well, they wrote them down, and then in the first century, the news about Jesus boomed. It spread all around, particularly the Mediterranean world. And because of that, in those days, there was no printing presses, but it would mean lots of copies would be made and then sent out in every direction. And now there's textual criticism is what we call the study then of the different documents, and then you can work out to a high, high degree of accuracy what the original said. And it's fair to say we can be incredibly confident that what we have in our hands is from the first century and from what was written. Now, at this point, you don't necessarily have to agree with it, but this is what was written back then, which we do have accurately in our hands. And there's all these documents we've now got. If you go up to Manchester, the John Rylands Library, there's a little bit of John's Gospel there, which has been accurately dated, not by Christians particularly, but generally accepted to be about 130 AD, which is just one generation from when it was written, so very close to the time. So all that is to say, we've got every reason historically to believe this document that we've got in our hands. It makes sense. And so therefore, initially, I'd say read this as a historical document. It's reliable. And ask yourself then, do you believe that it's credible, that what they wrote makes sense, and most of all, about the Jesus at the heart of it? So there was a question, wasn't there, about the details, things like his crucifixion, the existence of Jesus? Yes. Josephus was the main Jewish historian of the time, and he speaks of Jesus. Others speak, some of the Roman historians speak of the crucifixion and mention them, but not details, but in a sense, not surprisingly, because they are ones some steps removed from Jesus. So they could state some of the things that they had heard had happened, the claims that were made, but for the inside account, you need to read these Gospels. And again, come to your own decision about what they say about Jesus and does it stack up.
Let me just push you on some of the details, which is where this question goes. The marks in his hands, they could have just been bad scarring, this question says. How do we know that Jesus really died?
Let's turn to John chapter 19. Again, the historical background helps us. Remember, the Romans were skilled executioners. They crucified literally thousands of people. There is no record anywhere of someone surviving a crucifixion where the intent was to kill them. And then we read the account, and Jesus, in John 19, page 56, verse 30, when Jesus received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished." He bowed his head and gave up his spirit. You read on, and the Jews then, verse 31, ask Pilate that the legs of Jesus might be broken, because that would hasten death and it would happen quickly. But the soldiers came, they broke the legs of the two either side of Jesus. But when they came, verse 33, to Jesus, he was already dead. They did not break his legs, but they did then, verse 34, pierce his side with a spear. Now that would have killed him anyway, had he not been dead already. But doing that, then blood and water came out. And the medics will tell us now, we know for sure that was a sign that he had died. And again, remember the Romans, soldiers, the execution squad, if they failed to kill someone they'd been asked to execute, they would have been killed. So there's absolutely no reason to possibly think he hadn't died. He must have died. Was there a question that goes with that?
The scarring on his hands.
So you could say what if in all sorts of ways. There's a very clear explanation for what caused the scarring. Remember again, we're told that John, who wrote this, was at the foot of the cross. He saw it. So when he then writes of the nail marks and those sort of things, he knew what he was talking about.
Thank you. Well, let's build on that. Why did he, that's Jesus, choose death and resurrection? Is there an alternative? Is there anything else he could have done?
Yeah. I mean, that's a very good question, because it asks really, what do we deserve? If what we have done is what Jesus said and turned away from God and have, well, deserve his anger rightly, the judgment is death. Let's see that just from what Jesus says. John chapter 8.
And actually, this will be a good time to interrupt with another question, which is, why is God angry? You just mentioned God's anger. Can you just explain that?
Yes, okay. Well, let's start in John chapter 3. John chapter 1. Go to John 1. Let's just go all the way back. Just to set the scene, what's the, if you like, worldview? That is, what's the truth about our world? In the beginning, chapter 1, verse 1, was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him. Without him was not anything that has been made. God made everything, the world, every good thing, gave it to us to enjoy, and blessed us and said, enjoy it, it's for you. But then, chapter 3, verse 17, bottom of page 8. God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already, because he's not believed in the name of the only Son of God. So condemned, angry, God must judge. Why? The question came. This is the judgment. The light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light. So God made our world, made us, gave us every good thing, but we said no thanks to God. We wanted to live our way with us in charge, us at the centre. And then when God even came into our world in the person of Jesus, then all the more the world said no way, because we wanted to live our way. And that is the height of ingratitude and arrogance, and it deserves death. Jesus says that. Turn on to chapter 8. So he's speaking to those who are opposing him. Verse 21, page 25, verse 21. So Jesus said to them again, I'm going away, and you will seek me, and you will die in your sin. Then go on to verse 24. I told you that you would die in your sins, for unless you believe that I am he, you will die in your sins. Sins deserve death. And death there is not merely physical death, it's the judgment of God, which is ultimately to be separated from God. So it's fair, because it's actually what we ask for. If we've said to God, no thanks, go away, well, the worst thing God can do is to say, okay. Because with God is every good thing. And so if we are then separated from God and all that is good, in his anger, God rightly leaves us to what we've asked for. That will be experienced in death and judgment.
And can I just push you on the, is there anything else he could have done? Could he not have dealt with this some other way?
So the whole of the Bible, the Old Testament, makes it really clear. We like to think, don't we, but God could have said, it's all right, chill. I'll forgive you. The Bible says they can't do that, that sin, our way we treat God, actually matters. And you believe that too. Imagine the judge in the court case. The evidence is clear. The defendant is guilty of murder, of child abuse, of whatever it is. And then if the judge was to say, don't worry, it's fine. Off you go. We'd be outraged, and rightly so. We know there is such a thing as right and wrong. We know that behavior like that deserves to be punished. And that is a God-given sense inside us, which the whole Bible makes clear. And it's all the more serious when it comes to God. We must be punished. Sin deserves death. And that then points us to the rescue, to why Jesus came into the world. Are you going to ask another question, or are we on to that? Should we carry on?
You thinking of a particular question?
No. John 3:16, let's look at this well-known verse. So here we are. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. So there had to be a death, It had to be a human, a person, so the right kind of being, if you like, person had to be punished. The Old Testament had pointed the way with sacrifices, but those were animals. They could never really take the place of a person like us. God had a son who was innocent, who was perfect, and God in his love sent the most valuable thing, if you like, he had, his son. And his son had to die and experience what sin and judgment deserved. I read it briefly earlier. Do you remember when Jesus died, the words he said were, "It is finished." It being that someone had to pay the price for sin. Someone had to bear God's anger. And God so loved the world, that is, this world that's rebelled against him, that he said he would send his son to die in our place.
The result of that being one of the things you picked up on, peace. So can you just explain then sort of the more positive side? Why do I need peace with God?
Well, ask someone in the Syrian war zone, why do you need peace? Because war is horrendous. Again, we're slightly immune from it to some extent. If you are young, reasonably, life's going well, you don't yet experience in some ways the ravages of this world, you might think, well, everything's okay. Maybe you're doing well, earning enough money, all those kinds of things. Although I'd be surprised if there's anyone here who is untouched by our broken world and the effect that it has. Some of us no doubt will be suffering greatly. We know this world is not as it is. And the Bible says those are the symptoms of what is the true problem, the heart of it. We are, it's not too strong to say, at war with God. Just to see that, John 3:36, page 10. There are only two positions we can be in, according to Jesus. John 3:36. Whoever believes in the Son has eternal life. Whoever does not obey the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God remains on him. God is angry, he is at war. The only reason life now might have a measure of goodness is God in his kindness, being patient, giving us an opportunity to turn back to him. And then he has done everything in Jesus to give us peace. But without Jesus, that verse is very clear, we're not at peace. And that war that we are in, one day we will experience the consequences in full. Where, if you like, when God fully, in one sense, steps away with all his goodness, and there'll be nothing left then to experience but God's anger.
Thanks, Nairn. I've got three or four questions just to finish on implications. But just before we go there, we're sort of in good time. Does anyone want to push further on this issue? I mean, we're right at the heart of where Christianity really, really cashes out. God's wrath, Jesus' death and resurrection, and the peace that is available, as Nairn's just explained. Does anyone want to sort of follow-up question to any of those, just from the floor? Well, do feel free to sort of ask the person perhaps that brought you this evening if you want more clarification on those things. Now, a few things on some of the implications for this. So, what does it mean to be blessed in today's world?
So, we saw that Jesus picked that up saying, blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Remember this, what we've looked at tonight comes right at the end of John's gospel. So all the way through, he has talked about, if you like, the life that we've lost, the life that it was meant to be, the life that Jesus wants to bring back. So those miracles that he did, he calls them signs, they show who he is, but also the world he is going to bring into being. I mean, you may well be familiar with them. So where there is sickness, even death, he can undo it. But then positively as well, you know, people are stunned to find out the first miracle Jesus does in John's gospel is turning water into wine at a wedding, saying it's going to be a party, it's going to be a celebration, the finest fare will be on offer. That wonderful picture of his kingdom in the future will be a place, if you like, the hottest ticket you have ever had, because all that spoils it will be taken away, the very best will be there, and he'll be at the heart of it. That's what it means to be blessed. Let's just see where Jesus says that's what he's come to do. Turn to page 31, chapter 10. The So a biblical picture is that of pasture, so the sheep who are happy, in safety, resting, plenty of nourishment and enjoyment. Chapter 10, verse 10, top of page 31, Jesus says, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly." It's amazing. People sometimes think that the good life is to be had apart from Jesus, not realizing that anything that is truly good, even in this world, comes from Jesus. He created it. He made it. He gives it to us to enjoy. And so therefore, he knows what he's talking about. And he says he's come to give us life abundantly. So it won't be anything less than what we've got here. It'll be the very best of what we've got now, multiplied however many times. And then most of all, it will be knowing this Jesus. And the Jesus we meet here, if you get to know him, you think, that is the person I was made to know. So all the other things will be there as well, but at the heart of it will be Jesus. And the only way really to say, what will I be like? Well, read John's Gospel and remember, Jesus is giving a glimpse of the world he's come to bring, the life he's come to do that. And again, the cross again proves how great it must be. So verse 11 here, Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep." Why did Jesus go to the cross? Why did he endure such agony? What made Jesus think it would be worth it? Well, the life that he was winning for us, for those who would trust him. The agony he went through, he says, is worth it because of what my people, my sheep, will enjoy as a result. So this is the life we were made for.
That's very helpful. I think you've answered the next question. What is life in Jesus' name? Happy?
More the same.
More of the same. If we are not made for this world, why do we have to live in it? What's the point of life now?
It's a good question. And John's Gospel, it's a story of two halves, really. The first half, Jesus gives those miracles that show the new world, show who he is, persuade us of it. Second half, he then really is angling directly for the cross. He tells his disciples that he's going away, and they go, "What? Why?" They thought Jesus was about to usher in this amazing new world. And Jesus basically makes clear there's going to be a delay. So he's going to go away. He will come back to usher in this new world. But in between, well, what's going to happen? And that's where we are now. In one sense, Jesus says he wants us to be with him. In one sense, he almost wished we were there, no longer here. But he says there is, if you like, a window. Because Jesus' plan is not just for those original disciples. Remember, he had them so that they would then speak to others. And likewise, Jesus has decided the way the world will come to know him, hear about him, is as his people speak of him and take the message. So I think, biblically, the only reason we're waiting is so that more people can be added, so that more can hear of Jesus. So all of life is to be lived and to honour Jesus through it, but a priority driving us in everything will think, how can I make the most of this time we've got now to make Jesus known? And if you don't yet know Jesus, well, again, this is a time of great patience where the end should be now. And if we don't know Jesus, face God's anger. But there is this time when we can turn back and come to enjoy this life.
Two final questions. What if I can't believe because I like my life as it is and don't want to change my life? What do I do?
I would read John's Gospel and again ask yourself, who do you think Jesus is? If what I've said today is true about our rejection of God, the anger that we face, anyone would know that that's not true. It would be better not to face that. The one who says it is Jesus. Not me, not Chris, not the church. Jesus says that is our state. He tells us God's anger remains on us. He is the one who went to the cross because he thought that would be better so that we cannot have to face God's anger. So if you think my life is good now, I don't need to take Jesus' warning seriously, well, decide what you think about Jesus, because if, as I'm persuaded, the evidence shows you must take him seriously, then what he says is true. And I think only what he says will wake you up from your stupidity and come to your senses and come to Jesus.
I'll just push you on that a little bit further in terms of liking life. Because so I can relate to that question. I hear it often in the city. People love the life that they have. They don't want to turn their back on it. Can you just, I mean, people have different starting points for that. Can you just say a little bit more about counting the cost, what that actually looks like in practice?
In our folly, we've turned away from God, and part of that is we think we know what's best. We think we know where satisfaction and fulfillment is to be found, and we chase it in all the places. You know where we chase it. You could quite simply take a step back and ask, does it really satisfy and provide the meaning, however much we've chased it? Does it really do that? Jesus promises life in all its abundance. He does actually say life will be better now. So if you're not a Christian, you're looking in on Christians, you might think, I don't want that life. In one sense, you'd be right. Jesus promises here in, I mean, we've got nothing to hide. Let's see what Jesus says in John chapter 15. That's what he says to his disciples. Verse 18, if the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you. If you are of the world would love you as its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. So yes, the things we cling to, the respect of others and all those kinds of things, we may lose those. And don't mishear me, that is still hard for the Christian. But deep down it comes in the context of knowing Jesus, which at the same time is much better. So the Christian life is a challenge, it's hard, but actually knowing Jesus now, knowing my future, knowing the hope that we have, well, if you keep on listening to Jesus, you wouldn't actually turn away. And Jesus actually said, well, it's an amazing place where he says you are blessed. Turn back to John chapter 13. So you'll see the heading, Jesus washes the disciples' feet. And he says that you're to do the same. You're to actually give your life in service of others, which again is the complete opposite to what we think. We think, although we wouldn't say it, that life's about getting stuff for me. Jesus says, no. Even in this world, life should be the other way around, serving others. Read from verse 15. Jesus says, for I've given you an example that you also should do just as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. So Jesus is saying, you'll be treated as he was. You can't expect any different. He says, if you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. Those are amazing words. Jesus promises that actually, if you go all out following him, you will be blessed. And that doesn't mean just blessed in the future at some vague future point, but actually now. It's hard to explain because even now as a Christian, I have to make decisions that I find hard and I think this is simply going to cost me. But I can speak to the truth of Jesus' words as I look back now on however many years of following him. I wouldn't actually have it any other way. Even those times where I thought I was giving up huge things and it was very costly, I look back and I thank Jesus that I lived his way. With his help. So speak to Christians that you know. Ask them, what is it actually like following Jesus?
Really helpful. Just one final question, maybe briefly. How do I become a Christian? This questioner asks.
Turn to, well, why don't we just turn to where we were? John chapter 20, page 60. Excuse me. Top of the page. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So notice, John says this is enough. What you read here about Jesus really is enough to come to a decision. You can look into all sorts of other stuff. Please do. It all holds together. But here's enough. So read this, or Mark, Luke, John, any others, Matthew, and decide, and look what the issue is. Written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. The Christ, God's promised King, the Son of God, the one from God who was and is God. So it's all about Jesus. That's what you have to decide on. And if the evidence has persuaded you, then believe it, accept it. And in particular, at the end, it'll be that as you read, if you've read John, you'll have seen it's all about his death. And at the death, he said, it is finished. Notice here, there's nothing that you have to do. Believing is a response to what Jesus has done. Simply recognize that Jesus is who he says he is, that what he said is true, that you need what he says he will do for any who come to him. Believe it. And then he says, you have life in his name. It's as simple as that. Do ask others, do ask me, but it's all about Jesus. Come and recognize who he is, and if you accept that and believe it and trust him, then life is yours.
And Aaron, thank you very much. Well, we're pretty much at the end of our formal time together. Just a few final words from me before we close the evening. A few ways that you might like to take things that you've heard this evening forward. As I said earlier, I mean, there have been lots of conversations going on around the tables. People that brought you this evening, perhaps new people you've met, please do carry on those conversations both here and beyond. Ask the big questions. That's what we've tried to help everybody do this evening, is think about some of the big questions of life. And please do keep asking those questions. A couple of other things that you might also like to consider as well. These John's Gospels that you have on the tables, in your hands in many cases, please do take them away, gift from us. Read them for yourself over Easter and consider the eyewitness account again for yourself. It may be that you'd like to join us one Sunday. We meet not here, but over at St. Helens. That's a church next to the Gherkin. Again, the person that brought you can give you more details. 4 p.m. is the time that we meet together as a church family, and you'd be very welcome to join us there. Each week, we do one main thing through the service. We open the Bible, and we read a little bit of it, and we explain it. So you can carry on learning more about Jesus through our Sunday meetings as well. Well, that's the end of this evening. There's no need to rush off now. Do carry on those conversations. There'll be a few people coming around with drinks in a few minutes just to top up glasses. The building will certainly be open for the foreseeable future. I think at some point before midnight, we'll probably turn the lights off. But hope you have a good evening. I know some people have got supper plans as well, going on to supper. So have a good evening. Thank you for joining us this evening.